Well, brethren, in just a few weeks, we'll all be observing the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread as we do every year. And a subject that oftentimes comes up around this time of year and is oftentimes the subject of a great deal of debate is a subject that's oftentimes referred to as the Passover controversy. Now, the Passover controversy is primarily a debate regarding the timing of events around the original Passover in Exodus 12, and also a debate regarding the exact timing of the initial departure of the Israelites out of Egypt. But now, this debate tends to focus, again, primarily around the Old Covenant Passover. But in many cases, people will also then take their conclusions that they arrive at based upon that debate, and then use that as the basis to then debate the timing, around the New Covenant Passover in the New Testament. So what we're going to do today is to begin a two-part series addressing both of these issues. Today we're going to focus primarily on the Old Covenant Passover and the issues associated with that. And then next time we'll pick up and address the issues associated with the New Covenant Passover. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's The Passover Controversy, Part 1. Again, The Passover Controversy, Part 1. Now, to begin with, let me just kind of give you a brief overview of what this particular controversy is about. It really stems around the exact timing of when the actual sacrificing of the Passover lamb would take place. As we're going to see, the Bible gives us a specific window of time, that this sacrifice was to actually be performed. In other words, when the lamb would actually be killed and offered to God. Now, in both cases, the both sides, you might say, of this debate, typically agree that the killing of the lamb took place on the 14th of Nisan. That's not really a subject of debate for them. What they will debate is the exact timing of the day is when this took place. Now, one popular argument is that this took place at the very beginning of the 14th in a time period basically between sunset and dark, about a one-hour window there, that's when the lamb would be killed. Another popular argument is it was more in the mid-afternoon, basically arguing that the time frame the Bible is referring to is kind of early afternoon when the sun starts to go down in the sky all the way down to sunset. And so the point I want you to kind of see here is that both sides of this argument will agree that the sacrificing of the lamb itself takes place on the 14th. That's not in dispute. However, depending upon what argument you go with as to when exactly the lamb was sacrificed, that determines the date of when the Passover meal, when they would actually eat, the Passover lamb, and of course, the timing of when the firstborn were killed, as a part of the 10th plague in Egypt, that changes the date of this. Because if you go with the first argument and say that the lamb was killed between sunset and dark on the beginning of the 14th, well, of course, then the meal would be eaten on the night beginning the 14th. However, if you go with the argument that it was in the afternoon, the latter part of the day that the lamb was killed, well, then obviously the meal that would follow would then be the night beginning the 15th. So, that's a major difference there, because you'll oftentimes refer to this as a 14th versus 15th argument. And again, that's really when the meal is. That's not when the sacrifice is done. Now, the reason I kind of make a big deal out of that is we're about to see one of the things that we need to really focus on in solving this debate is the importance of defining the terms that the Bible refers to. And to see what I'm referring to, turn over to Leviticus 23. And we'll see here a very good example of the important terms here that we need to define and how a particular verse is oftentimes misused because people are arguing from it, oftentimes not understanding the terms that this particular verse uses. And the verse I'm referring to is Leviticus 23 and verse 5. It says, on the 14th day of the first month at twilight is Jehovah's Passover. Now, what I was referring to is how oftentimes this verse gets misused, is I've seen this happen numerous times throughout my lifetime. And in fact, I think many years ago, I was probably guilty of this myself. When this particular debate would come up, people would read this one verse and say, see, it says 14th, end of discussion. You know, and what they meant by saying that is they're basically assuming that this verse is defining not only the timing of the sacrifice, but the timing of the meal and the timing of the death of the firstborn. And they're not understanding the terms that are used here in this verse, because this verse doesn't specify any of those. If you're using this verse as a standalone, it doesn't solve the argument at all. Because you need to understand here, when it refers to at twilight, here in the New King James, this comes from the Hebrew term ben harbihim. Now, you're probably familiar with the term between the two evenings, but because this is the Hebrew term that in English, if you gave it a meaning, it basically means between the two evenings. And again, this whole debate of, you know, the beginning of the 14th or the latter part of the 14th is all based upon how each side defines that particular term. But again, at this point, just take note of the fact that we're talking about a window of time on the 14th. You know, and as I mentioned before, both sides of this debate agree upon the fact that this window of time takes place on the 14th. That's not in dispute. Now, again, you can argue it's a one-hour period of time between sunset and dark at the beginning of the 14th, or you can argue that it's an afternoon time frame, you know, basically beginning when the sun starts to make its descent in the sky, you know, down to the point of sunset. So it's a several-hour window. Again, we'll get later into the details of how to determine from the Bible which one is correct. Just take note of the fact that we're talking about a limited window of time on the 14th. We're not defining Passover as a calendar day. We're not defining it as a 24-hour period, you know, from sunset to sunset. That's not what this verse says. And see, when people are arguing and trying to, you know, basically say, well, this concludes the argument, and you've got to put, you know, the meal and the death of the firstborn and everything in there, well, they're not even understanding the terms of what this verse says. Because let's notice, for starters, that what this is defining for us is the appointed time of Passover. Because we're going to see the Bible uses that term numerous times. You know, that this is the appointed time of Passover. Also notice that verse 5 says, this is Passover. In other words, it's telling us that the definition of Passover is what takes place in this window of time. And that's very important, so we can, again, first define the term Passover as the Bible uses it. Because what we've unfortunately done in our modern-day Church of God culture is we've treated the term Passover like it's equivalent to saying Pentecost or trumpets or atonement. Because, you know, if you read later in this chapter, Leviticus 23, those are all holy days that are, you know, discussed in this chapter, and they're defined as a 24-hour period from sunset to sunset. And we've tended to use Passover as if it's the same thing. And notice that's not what verse 5 said. It said Passover is a window of time on that day. See, that changes the definition. But let's just notice here, when I mentioned talking about the appointed time of Passover, notice in verse 4, it says, these are the feasts of Jehovah, holy convocations which you shall proclaim at their appointed times. And then it goes throughout the whole chapter, and it's basically listing all of the appointed times, all of the times that God gave specific instructions for us to do. Now, again, I won't address all of this in this sermon. I covered this in a sermon a couple of years ago. There's a sermon you can look on my YouTube channel and on my website. There's a sermon entitled, Not All Appointed Times Are Sabbaths. Because I point out the fact that, you know, for example, Passover and the Wave Sheaf Sunday are both mentioned in this chapter, but they're not commanded to be Sabbaths. It doesn't say, you know, you shall do no work on these. They're not set aside as a 24-hour period, you know, that's treated as a Sabbath. They're appointed times, and those are different. But again, let's just notice that the appointed time for Passover was a window of time on the 14th, not the whole day as a 24-hour period. That's very important in understanding the definition. Now, turn over to Numbers chapter 9. I want you to see here several more times where the Bible again specifically refers to this window of time that, you know, in Hebrew is ben harbihim, meaning between the two evenings. And it's going to repeatedly refer to this as the appointed time of Passover, that this is when you keep the Passover, is that window of time. So it's defining Passover as what happens between in that window of time. So now let's pick up in Numbers 9 and verse 2. It says, let the children of Israel keep the Passover at its appointed time. Now let's notice the next verse is going to tell us what that appointed time is. On the 14th day of this month, at twilight. Again, it's at twilight here in English in my New King James. But again, this is Ben Harbahim, you know, between the two evenings. That's what it's referring to as the appointed time of Passover. And you shall keep it at its appointed time. According to all of its rites and ceremonies, you shall keep it. So Moses told the children of Israel that they should keep the Passover. And they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month at twilight. In other words, Ben Harbahim, between the two evenings. That's when they kept Passover. Now we're going to see here later, that's a window of time that the sacrifice fits into. The meal and the death of the firstborn will not fit into that time frame. That's just an important to understand the definition of the term. Now continue in verse 5. In the wilderness of Sinai, according to all that Jehovah commanded Moses, so the children of Israel did. Now skip down to verse 9. And again, we're going to skip over some of the context here, but a lot of the focus of this chapter is instituting the second Passover. You know, if someone wasn't able to keep the first Passover, there was another option in the second month of the year, and it was also on the 14th day. But again, let's take note of the fact the appointed time is not that the 14th as a whole; it's a window of time on that day, and this is picking up in verse 9. Then Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, if any one of you or your posterity is unclean because of a dead body, or is far away on a journey, he may still keep Jehovah's Passover on the 14th day of the second month at twilight, or it's between the two evenings, Ben Harbahim. And they shall keep it. Then they shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, and they shall leave none of it until morning, nor break one of its bones. According to all the ordinance of the Passover, they shall keep it. But the man who is clean and is not on a journey and ceases to keep the Passover, that same person shall be cut off from among his people, because he did not bring the offering of Jehovah at its appointed time. That man shall bear his sin. I notice it said it's bringing the offering at its appointed time. It's referring to actually sacrificing the lamb. And to see that, turn over to Exodus 12. We'll see here the instructions for the original Passover. But let's notice specifically what takes place in this time frame, you know, this in Hebrew, Ben Harbahim, or between the two evenings, what actually takes place in that time frame that it's defining as Passover. This is going to be start in verse 5 of Exodus 12. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. Again, that's Ben Harbahim between the two evenings. So what's taking place in that time frame is the sacrificing of the lamb. And now pay attention to the fact that Leviticus 23 told us that Passover is what takes place between the two evenings. So the sacrificing of the lamb is defined as Passover. And in verse 7, and they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs, they shall eat it. I notice it's that night. It's specifying exactly when you sacrifice the lamb and then saying, well, that night is when you're going to eat it. So obviously it's the night immediately following when you'd sacrifice the lamb. But again, to nail this down, we're going to have to see when exactly is that time frame. But at this point, just take note of the fact that you can get the sacrificing of the lamb to fit into either argument, you know, as to when Ben Harbahim is defined as, you cannot get the meal and the death of the firstborn to fit into that time frame. Because it's, you know, that's different, that's included in the overall picture, but that's not what the Bible is defining as Passover. And it's important to realize that. Because remember, you know, the Bible directly tells us that the death of the firstborn happened at midnight. Now, if you define Ben Harbahim as between sunset and dark, you got about a 1-hour window. If you define it as the afternoon time frame, you've got a several hour window. In either case, you're not going to have the meal, and you certainly cannot get the death of the firstborn to fit into that time frame. So again, this is understanding our terms here. But now let's go back and read through the kind of the context around the verses we just read here. We're going to start here in verse 3 of Exodus 12. Because what I want you to notice is the language around this and how it refers to the Passover. Because it's going to refer to taking a lamb and sacrificing it. And then it's going to talk about how you kill it, you roast it, you eat it, and it's going to keep referring to it. And then in verse 11, it's going to say it is Jehovah's Passover. The point I want you to see is Passover, by definition, is a sacrifice. Pick up in verse 3 here of chapter 12. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him, his neighbor next to his house, take it according to the number of the persons. According to each man's need, he shall make a count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You shall take it from the sheep and or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight, again between the two evenings, and they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel and the houses, where they shall eat it. And they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire, with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs, they shall eat it. Do not eat it raw, nor boil it with water, but roast it in fire, its heads and its legs and its entrails. And you shall let none of it remain until morning. What remains of it until morning shall burn with fire. And thus you shall eat it with a belt on your waist and sandals on your feet and a staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is Jehovah's Passover. Notice you kill the Passover, you roast the Passover, you eat the Passover. The Passover is a sacrifice. Because if you try to define it as a calendar day, you know, as a 24-hour period, this language doesn't make any sense. If you're referring to a sacrifice, it makes perfect sense. And to see some more examples of this, turn over to 2 Chronicles chapter 30. And I just want you to notice the consistency of the language used to refer to Passover. Because again, I think it's very important in understanding this subject to realize, you know, particularly when you're reading the Old Testament, you know, that when you see the term Passover, it's not referring to a 24-hour day. It's referring to a sacrifice. It's by definition a sacrifice. Now, it gets a little more complicated when you get into to the New Testament, because again, in the Old Testament, the Passover is a lamb that was, you know, sacrificed to God at the temple or the tabernacle according to biblical instructions, you know, and it was part of the Passover ceremony. That was the definition of Passover. Now, in the New Testament, it can have that definition. It can also refer to Christ as our Passover sacrifice. That can also get a little more complicated because by the New Testament time frame, the Jews started using it as a cultural reference, you know, kind of lumping in unleavened bread as well, just kind of as a generic reference to the spring holy days. There's a few times in the New Testament it's used like that. So in the New Testament, again, context becomes an important issue. In the Old Testament, when you read this, Passover refers to a lamb. It refers to a sacrifice. And to see this, let's pick up in 2 Chronicles 30 in verse 15. Then they slaughtered the Passover. Now, again, my New King James adds the words lambs here in italics, but let's just notice that that's in italics. It's not in the original Hebrew. In other words, the translators inserted these words. In fact, in this section of Scripture and another section we're about to read in Chronicles, you're going to see the word lambs and the word offerings, you know, basically inserted in italics after the word Passover several times, because the translators assumed that that was necessary, you know, to clarify the meaning. They weren't grasping that Passover, by definition, is a sacrifice. But just continue on in verse 15. On the 14th day of the second month, the priests and the Levites were ashamed and sanctified themselves and brought the burnt offerings to the house of Jehovah. And they stood in the place according to their custom, according to the law of Moses, the man of God. And the priests sprinkled the blood which they received from the hands of the Levites. For there were many in the congregation that had not sanctified themselves. Therefore the Levites had charge of the slaughter of the Passover. And again, lambs is inserted here. Again, not in the original. For everyone who was not clean, and to sanctify them to Jehovah. For the multitude of the people, many from Ephraim, Manasseh, Issachar, and Zebulun, had not cleansed themselves, and yet they ate the Passover contrary to what was written. But Hezekiah prayed for them, saying, May the good Jehovah provide atonement for everyone. And he who prepares his heart to seek God, and Jehovah, God of his fathers, though he is not cleansed according to the purification and the sanctuary. Now turn over to 2 Chronicles 35. We'll see here this similar language again. But just again, you'll see here, as I mentioned before, where we saw the word lambs inserted, here we're going to see the word offerings inserted. But again, it's in italics. It's not in the original Hebrew. But notice again this same language of you kill the Passover, you slaughter the Passover, you roast the Passover, you eat the Passover. This language only makes sense if we're talking about a sacrifice. And again, I think this is a very important thing to emphasize, because again, I know in my lifetime in our COG culture, we've synonymized the term Passover, you know, just like it's referring to Pentecost or atonement or trumpets. In other words, referring to a 24-hour day as if that's how the term should be used. It's not how the Bible uses the term. The Passover refers to a sacrifice, and that's very important because, again, you have to understand the terms you're reading to be able to understand, you know, the concepts being taught associated with them. But let's pick up in verse 1 of 2 Chronicles 35. Now Josiah kept the Passover to Jehovah in Jerusalem, and they slaughtered the Passover. Again, lambs is inserted here in italics, not in the original. Not in the 14th, on the 14th day of the first month. And he set the priests in their duties and encouraged them for the service of the house of Jehovah. Then he said to the Levites who taught all Israel, who were holy to Jehovah, put the holy ark in the house which Solomon the son of David, the king of Israel, built. It shall no longer be a burden on the shoulders. Now serve Jehovah your God and his people Israel. Prepare yourselves according to your father's houses, according to your divisions, following the written instruction of David, king of Israel, and the written instruction of Solomon his son. And stand in the holy grace according to the divisions of the fathers, houses of your brethren, the lay people, according to the divisions of the father's house, to the Levites. So slaughter the Passover. Now, again, as I mentioned, offerings, this, you know, this word is inserted in italics here in the New King James. It's not in the original. It just says slaughter the Passover in the original Hebrew. Sanctify yourselves and prepare them for your brethren, that they may do according to the word of Jehovah by the hand of Moses. Then Josiah gave the lay people lambs and young goats from the flock, all for Passover. And again, the word offerings is inserted here again, not in the original. For all who were present, to the number of 30,000, as well as 3,000 cattle, these were from the king's possessions. And his leaders gave willingly to the people, to the priests and to the Levites, Hilkiah, Zechariah, and Jehiel, rulers of the house of God. Gave to the priests for the Passover, again, offerings is inserted there, 2,600 from the flock and 300 cattle. Also, so Cananiah and his brothers, Shemaiah, and Nethael, and Hezabiah, and Jeiel, and Jozabad, chiefs of the Levites, gave to the Levites for Passover, again, offerings is inserted, 5,000 from the flock and 500 cattle. So the service was prepared, and the priests stood in the places, and the Levites in their divisions according to the king's command. And they slaughtered the Passover. Again, offerings is again inserted, not in the original. And the priests sprinkled the blood with their hands, while the Levites skinned the animals. And they removed the burnt offerings, and they might have them in the divisions of the fathers' houses of the lay people to offer to Jehovah, as it is written in the book of Moses, so they did with the cattle. And they roasted the Passover. Again, offerings is again inserted with fire according to the ordinance. But the other holy offerings, they boiled in pots, in cauldrons, and in pans, and divided them quickly among the lay people. So you can see here, again, if you just pay attention, again, not only to the language, you know, which is, you know, kill the Passover, roast the Passover, eat the Passover, slaughter the Passover. Obviously, the Passover is a sacrifice. We also noticed in Leviticus 23, you know, verse 5, it said Passover is what takes place between the two evenings on the 14th. Again, it didn't define Passover as the 24-hour period of the 14th. It said Passover is what takes place in that window of time. Now, again, we're going to get into more detail here in a minute, how you define that window of time and how you nail that down. But again, let's just notice how it's defining Passover. Because, see, this adds a lot of clarity to why the New Testament says Christ is our Passover. Because turn over to 1 Corinthians 5. And we'll see here this statement, which you're probably familiar with, but again, if you just think this through, it again clarifies again the definition of the term Passover, that it's a sacrifice. But again, 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 7, therefore purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump and a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Now just think this through, just to kind of hammer this point. Is Christ our Nisan the 14th? No, he's our Passover sacrifice. You know, he's the sacrifice that atones for our sins and took on the death penalty for us. You know, he fulfills that role. Is he a calendar day? No. He's also not our jumping over. Now, the reason I mention that is sometimes people get confused on this whole subject of Passover because they read through Exodus 12 and they see that in English it refers to Passover, one word, you know, which refers again specifically to a sacrifice. And then they see the words Passover, two words, you know, used in a similar context, and they assume because this sounds the same in English that this is a related meaning. In other words, they assume because it says that, you know, the Lord passed over the door, you know, that is why the sacrifice is referred to as Passover. That is an unfortunate translation in English that has blurred that whole subject. Now I won't get into all the details on this. If you want to kind of explore the Hebrew words that are involved in this, there's a couple of study papers on my website. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you look just right below this video, you'll see a link that if you click on it, it'll take you straight to my website. There are two papers that address the subject of the Passover, both the Old Covenant and New Covenant Passovers, in a lot more detail than we're going to have time to address in this series. As I mentioned in the introduction here, this particular series is really going to focus more around the issues of this timing debate associated with both Passovers, not going to really get into all the other extended issues of its meaning and, you know, all the other things associated with this and all the other arguments that are made. However, there are two study papers on my website that much more thoroughly address all of these other issues. And if you're interested in studying those, again, you can go to my website. You know, the titles make it obvious what the papers are addressing. One's entitled The Old Covenant Passover. The other is entitled The New Covenant Passover. They're kind of self-explanatory as to what they address. But as I mentioned, this whole distinguishing between Passover, one word, which refers to the sacrifice, and Passover, two words, you know, that's also used in Exodus 12. If you look at the paper addressing the Old Covenant Passover, it's going to give you, you know, the Hebrew words used in both of these and dig more in detail to define them and to, you know, to kind of address that whole subject. But just to kind of briefly address this, when it refers to, you know, it says, you know, Jehovah or the Lord, you know, passed over the door. You know, that basically when he gets, you know, into Israel that night, you know, into Egypt, you know, when the Israelites were there in Goshen and sees the blood on the door, well, he'll pass over the door. And you read that in English and it sounds like he's jumping over the door. Okay, well, just logically think that through. You know, the whole issue here is the destroyer, who's Satan, you know, is coming to kill the firstborn. And God allows him to kill the firstborn of all the Egyptians, but all the Israelites who followed the instructions and killed the Passover lamb and put the blood on the door and on the doorpost, you know, when he sees that, you know, it says in English, he passes over the door. How would that stop the destroyer from coming in? It doesn't make a lot of sense when you think it through. Well, as you'll see in that study paper, that I referenced on my website, it goes into demonstrating that the Hebrew word there can mean Passover, like to jump over something. It can also mean to spare or protect. And see, that's obviously a much more applicable meaning when you look at the context. Because if he's protecting the door, he's essentially barring the door and stopping the destroyer from coming in and killing the firstborn. So, see, once you understand that, you don't get confused and think, well, it's called Passover because he passed over the door. No, it's, again, two completely separate Hebrew words. Passover, you know, is one word, specifically refers to a sacrifice, and Passover, two words, again, totally different meaning there, you know, and it's just the unfortunate translations in English have blurred the subject. Because, see, that's why people get confused and mystifying the term Passover. Then they turn to Leviticus 23, verse 5, and say, well, this conclusively just solves the whole argument. Passover 14th, end of discussion. No need to look any further. Because they don't realize what that verse is referring to is the actual giving of the sacrifice. It is not referring to the meal and the death of the firstborn. Because you can't fit in. You know, there's no scenario you can go with for what Ben-Harbahim means that's going to fit, you know, and get the meal and the death of the firstborn to fit into either one of those time frames. Doesn't matter which definition that you use. It's really not going to matter. You know, because again, those are kind of separate issues. When the Bible uses the term Passover, it's specifically referring to the sacrifice. That's why when it says Christ is our Passover, he's not our Nisan the 14th, and he's not our jumping over anything. He's our atoning sacrifice. And see, once you understand that, that is the key to unpacking a lot of issues associated with debates around both the Old Covenant and New Covenant Passover, is understanding that the Bible defines Passover as a sacrifice. So now that we understand that term, now, as I mentioned when we went through Leviticus 23, verse 5, so there's two terms here that we need to understand, because again, oftentimes this debate, you know, gets argued from people not understanding either term, you know, and then they go round and round with each other, you know, and sometimes they're even making arguments using terms that they don't even understand what the verse that they're using as evidence is even actually saying, you know, because as I mentioned, both sides agree that the sacrifice takes place on the 14th. You know, they just debate which window of time that we're talking about. You know, or is it talking about a time frame for, you know, beginning at, you know, between sunset and, you know, and dark, you know, approximately about an hour, Or does this term refer to an afternoon time frame that it begins about the time that, you know, the sun is beginning to make its descent in the sky, you know, down to the point of sunset being a several hour window of the day? That's the key of the debate. And again, Leviticus 23 verse 5 in and of itself doesn't answer that question. You have to go a little further. But the other thing that's important in defining the terms here is the importance of looking at all of the scriptures that use some of the important terms you're looking at. And I'm referring, you know, specifically to the debate of when exactly does the Bible define Ben Harbahim between the two evenings is taking place. Because I'm about to show you here is there's a particular couple of verses that are really helpful in, you know, basically clarifying this whole debate that oftentimes just get completely ignored and not even brought into the discussion. Or if they're brought up, they're just kind of ignored and people argue around them. And before I just turn to these specific scriptures, let me use another example that's a lot less debated in Church of God circles, so you can kind of see the logic of where I'm going. Now, you're probably familiar with the debate, you know, around the timing of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And now you're probably familiar with the fact that the most common, you know, popular religion today argument regarding the timing of this is what's oftentimes referred to as Good Friday and Easter Sunday. In other words, the idea that, well, Christ was killed on a Friday afternoon and he's put in the grave, you know, not long before sunset, you know, right as the sun is setting on Friday afternoon before the weekly Sabbath, and he's resurrected Sunday morning. Well, the problem with that argument is Christ specifically said he was going to be in the grave 3 days and three nights. And see, once you take that into consideration, that match is not going to work. You know, because you've got Friday night and you've got Saturday night to work with, you don't even have a third night to even make an argument that you have a portion of it. The math just doesn't work. But let me tell you an experience I went through in kind of, I want to say my early to mid-teenage years, just to kind of illustrate this point. You know, I was attending school, you know, like most kids my age in that time frame, and it was around the spring of the year. And the teacher I had, I forget what subject that they were, you know, what class it was, but, you know, the teacher wound up getting into a discussion, kind of talking about Good Friday and Easter Sunday. And being the zealot kid that I was, you know, I had to raise my hand and point out the fact that the math just doesn't work. You know, Christ said 3 days and three nights, and you might argue parts 3 days, but you don't have three nights to work with. There's just nowhere to go here. You know, well, my teacher kind of gave me a, you know, kind of a brush off argument, but let me just tell you the logic that she used, because this is kind of common in that particular debate. Well, she looked at me and she goes, well, James, you have to understand it's an expression. She said, it's like saying I went somewhere and I spent the weekend. She said, if I leave on Friday and I come back on Sunday, well, I spent the weekend. You know, and it's parts of 3 days. You know, and I pointed out to her, no, it's 3 days and three nights. You're going to need 72 hours, and you don't have a third night to even argue that you have a portion of. Well, she would just ignore that and, you know, kind of repeat her talking points, you know. And but the reason I point that out is if you look at this, you know, at the verses, you know, addressing the timing there again of Christ's death and resurrection, there's a number of times in the Bible it refers to, you know, on the third day or after 3 days, or, you know, it'll just mention 3 days. And yeah, you could try to make that argument if you only focus on those verses. But if you then look at the ones where Christ specifically said, I'm going to be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth, you know, meaning the grave, okay, you got to have a third night, and the math's just not going to work. You know, so the only way you can continue to make that popular argument is you just have to ignore the scriptures that don't match with the scenario that you want to argue. Well, we have similar scriptures when it comes to the whole argument as to when exactly is between the two evenings, or Ben Harbahim. And that's the scriptures defining the timing of the evening sacrifice. Now turn over to Exodus chapter 29, and you'll see what I'm referring to here. Because we're about to look at a couple of sections of scripture that specifically refer to the daily sacrifices that Israel was commanded to perform. Now, again, we'll look here in a minute in the book of Numbers, but if you go through Numbers 28 and 29, what you'll see is, you know, it defines all of the sacrifices. It starts off, you know, talking about, you know, the daily sacrifice. It mentions the weekly Sabbath. It mentions the sacrifices at the new moon and then all of the holy days. It just kind of lays everything out in those couple of chapters. And we're gonna look at Numbers here in just a minute. But it refers to there what's called the daily sacrifice. Now, there were two daily sacrifices that had to be performed every single day. There's what they call the morning sacrifice, and then the Bible also refers to what it calls the evening sacrifice. But it specifies the timing of the evening sacrifice as at Ben Harbihim, in other words, between the two evenings. It's the exact same terminology that's used in regards to Passover. But again, I've oftentimes noticed in my lifetime, when people make these arguments about Passover, they focus on all the verses that talk about Passover, you know, and they argue that, you know, both ways, depending on how they want to see it. But oftentimes people don't turn over to the verses that are addressing the evening sacrifice, because this makes an argument that makes it rather clear that you just can't get around. Now, let's pick up here in Exodus 29 in verse 38. Now, this is what you shall offer on the altar. Two lambs of the first year, day by day, continually. In other words, this is a daily sacrifice that you do every day. But let's notice that it's in two parts, and let's notice the order they're mentioned in. This is in verse 39. One lamb you shall offer in the morning, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight. Again, that's Ben Harbihim. If you look up the Hebrew here, this is the exact same term we saw in Exodus 12 and Leviticus 23, defining the timing of the Passover sacrifice. It's the exact same terminology. So it's telling us the evening sacrifice that they did after the morning sacrifice on the same day is defined as happening on Ben Harbihim. We'll just continue reading in verse 40. With the one lamb shall be one-tenth of an ephah of flour mixed with one-fourth of a hin of pressed oil, and one-fourth of a hin of wine as a drink offering. And the other lamb you shall offer at twilight between the two evenings, and you shall offer it with grain offering in the drink offering as in the morning, or the sweet aroma, an offering made by fire to Yehovah. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that the Bible defines days as sunset to sunset. So the day actually starts with the night portion, you know, beginning at sunset, and it ends at sunset, you know, at the end of the daylight portion, you know, and then that you know, after sunset, that's the beginning of the next day. Now, if we have two sacrifices and we're going to do them on the same calendar day, and we got to do a morning sacrifice before the evening sacrifice, and it's on the same day, then the evening sacrifice has got to be prior to sunset. Because if it's after sunset, you're not on the same day, you're now on the next day. You know, the clock just started over. So if Ben Harbihim was going to be the time frame between sunset and dark, in other words, at the very beginning of a day, then it would have to come prior to the morning sacrifice. It can't come after the morning sacrifice and still be on the same day. Again, this is like arguing that, you know, you can get 3 days and three nights in between, you know, sunset on Friday, you know, and Sunday morning. The math just doesn't work. I mean, you just have to abandon your math skills to be able to come up with that. Well, we have the same thing. We have to abandon our logic skills. You know, if we know that the Bible defines a day as sunset to sunset, and it starts with the night portion, that's the beginning of the day, and it ends with sunset, you know, right before it gets dark to start another day, well, if the morning sacrifice becomes before the evening sacrifice on the same calendar day, you got to have that evening sacrifice before sunset. It's got to be in the afternoon. There's no other way to do the math. So let's turn over to Numbers 28, and we'll see this again. As I mentioned before, Numbers 28, you know, and 29, you know, give us the, you know, all the sacrifices and, you know, all the details that God laid out. It starts with the daily offerings and, you know, goes to the weekly Sabbath, goes to the new moons, tells us all the holy days and everything that's commanded. But let's pick up here in verse in chapter 28 here and pick up in verse 3 here. Because again, if you have a New King James like I do, at the beginning of chapter 28, you'll see the subheading is daily offering. So this is the daily sacrifice they had to do every single day. And let's once again notice there's a morning sacrifice and an evening sacrifice on the same calendar day. The evening sacrifice has got to be before sunset. Again, otherwise you're arguing that you can get 3 days and three nights between Friday afternoon and Sunday morning. Math just doesn't work like that. Okay, let's pick up here in verse 3. And you shall say to them, this is the offering made by fire, which you shall offer to Jehovah. Two male lambs in their first year without blemish, day by day, as a regular burnt offering. And one lamb you shall offer in the morning, the other lamb you shall offer in the evening. So this is why it's referred to as the evening sacrifice. Today, with how we look at time and use language, we would call this the afternoon sacrifice. But in verse 5, in one-tenth of an ephah of fine flour as a grain offering mixed with one-fourth of a hin of pressed oil. It is a regular burnt offering which was ordained in Mount Sinai for sweet aroma, an offering made by fire to Jehovah. And its drink offering shall be one-fourth of a hin, and each lamb in the holy place you shall pour out the drink to Jehovah as an offering. The other lamb you shall offer in the evening as the morning grain offering and its drink offering. And you shall offer it as an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to Jehovah. See, once you add in these verses, you know, as I mentioned, it's the logical equivalent of looking at the argument around, you know, the timing of Christ's death and resurrection, you know, and you add in the verses 3 days and three nights. Well, once you add that in, the Friday, you know, afternoon to Sunday morning, you just can't get that math to work. You just have to abandon your math skills, you know, to get that to work. Well, in this case, again, if you've got the evening sacrifice that's defined as happening between the two evenings, you know, the exact same Hebrew that we see associated with the Passover, and you've got a morning sacrifice and an evening sacrifice on the same calendar day, Ben Arbahim has got to be an afternoon time frame. You know, otherwise we have to abandon our logic skills, you know, to continue arguing otherwise. And just to further clarify this from history, you're probably familiar, or at least have heard of, the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus. Now, he lived, you know, he was born during the Second Temple period, not long, and I won't say in the years not long after Christ was crucified. But you know, the temple wasn't destroyed until 70 AD by the Romans. So Josephus actually lived during the several decade period there when the Second Temple, you know, was still in existence and the sacrifices were still being done. And later, Josephus, you know, wrote his historical account of these events. You know, he's a famous Jewish historian. Now, what I want to read to you is a short section from his book, Antiquity of the Jews. Now, he's not just directly addressing, you know, the Passover debate that we're talking about here. He's just going to end having a discussion here talking about, you know, the interaction between the Romans and the Jews and what life was like for them during the Roman occupation there. You know, but he's going to reference the fact of how the Romans didn't interfere with the Jews doing their sacrifices. And he's going to specifically tell us the time of day, you know, of the evening sacrifice that we just read about. Because he's going to mention the daily sacrifices, that there's a morning and an evening sacrifice, but he's going to specify the hour for us. So let's notice this. This is from, again, Flavius Josephus' book, Antiquity of the Jews. It's from Book 14, Chapter 4, Section 3. It says, quote, which thing, when the Romans understood, on those days which we call Sabbaths. They threw nothing at the Jews, nor came to any pitched battle with them, but raised up their earthen banks and brought their engines into such forwardness that they might do execution the next days. And anyone may hence learn how very, very great piety we exercise towards God and the observance of his laws, since the priests were not at all hindered from their sacred ministrations by their fear during this siege, but did still twice each day in the morning and about the ninth hour offer their sacrifices on the altar, nor did they admit those sacrifices. See, Josephus is telling us that, you know, the Romans didn't interfere with the Jews doing the daily sacrifice, which, as we just read, consisted of two parts, a morning sacrifice and an evening sacrifice, again, which today in our terminology we'd refer to as afternoon, you know, is to how we use the terminology today. But notice he specifically said it's in the ninth hour. Now, to put that in modern-day terminology in terms of how we reckon time, that would be approximately about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But now let's take note of the fact that the New Testament, in fact, three of the gospel accounts, you know, that record Christ's death, you know, his ministry and even his death and crucifixion and resurrection, make a big point of pointing out to us that Christ, who is our Passover sacrifice, you know, was killed as a sacrifice to God at the ninth hour, which just so happens to be the timing, not only the timing of the evening sacrifice, but the appointed time of Passover. Now, turn over to Matthew chapter 27. It's Matthew 27. Because what we're going to see here is Matthew, Mark, and Luke all make a point of telling us the exact hour around when Christ was killed, which, again, just so happens to correlate with exactly the appointed time for the Passover sacrifice, and Christ is our Passover sacrifice. So let's pick up here in verse 45. Now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness over the land. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, and that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of those who stood there, when they heard that, said, this man is calling for Elijah. And immediately one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. And the rest said, let him alone. Let us see if Elijah will come to save him. And Jesus then, when he had cried out again with a loud voice, yielded up his spirit. In other words, he died. You know, this is telling us around the ninth hour, or again, around the timing of the evening sacrifice, which is also, interestingly enough, the timing of the Passover sacrifice, is exactly when Christ, who is our Passover, died. Now, let's notice this again in Mark chapter 15. And we're going to see Matthew, Mark, and Luke all make a point of being very specific about this. Mark 15, in verse 33. Now when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of those who stood by, when they heard it, said, look, he is calling for Elijah. Then someone ran and filled a sponge full of sour wine, put it on a reed, and offered it to him to drink, saying, let him alone. Let us see if Elijah will come to take him down. And Jesus cried out with a loud voice and breathed his last. Notice once again, it makes a point of telling us Christ dies around the ninth hour. Now let's notice Luke makes a point of telling us the same thing. This is Luke chapter 23 and verse 44. And it was about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over all, and the earth until the ninth hour. And then the sun was darkened, and the veil of the temple was torn in two. And when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. Again, all three accounts make a very big point of telling us that Christ died on the ninth hour. Now, again, as we read earlier, you know, Paul told us in 1 Corinthians 5 that Christ is our Passover. Now, obviously, if Christ is going to be our Passover sacrifice, he would have to be, you know, sacrificed at the appointed time of the Passover sacrifice. I mean, just to have a little fun and be sarcastic about this, you know, when you look at all of the details here and it, you know, telling us repeatedly he dies at the ninth hour, it's almost like some great master planner made a real big point of making sure that our Passover sacrifice, Jesus Christ, is sacrificed at the appointed time for offering the Passover sacrifice, and then caused three gospel accounts to make sure that we couldn't miss it. See, it's very obvious if we put all that together, Ben Harbaheem has to be an afternoon time frame. Now, what that tells us is, again, the Passover sacrifice was offered in the afternoon. That means the meal that they ate in the death of the firstborn, just by sheer logic, then has to take place the night beginning the 15th, if we're just consistent with this. Now, this probably goes against what a lot of you have been taught all of your life. I know for much of my life, you know, I was believing and was taught that, no, that the night beginning the 15th, well, that's when the Israelites are, you know, beginning their march out of Egypt. You know, well, we came up with that by misinterpreting two scriptures. And you know, again, we did it, I think, with good intentions and trying to obey God. But we're going to be about to look at these two verses and see that they don't actually say what we think that they say. Now, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 16. Because what's this going to see here? Verse 1 is typically used as the conclusive proof to say, yes, the Israelites, they marched out on the night beginning the 15th. You know, so obviously they couldn't have been eating the meal because, you know, they had to be marching out at that time. And people would turn to this verse and quote it as if that definitively makes the argument. But now let's notice what it actually says and what it doesn't specifically say. This is Deuteronomy 16 in verse 1. Observe the month of the Aviv and keep the Passover to Jehovah your God. For in the month of the Aviv, Jehovah your God brought you out of the land of Egypt. Notice it does not say they physically marched out at night. It says he brought them out by night. But now let's notice several times where similar statements are made. And what he's referring to is, you know, bringing them out with a strong hand and through miracles. And it refers to the death of the firstborn and the plagues in Egypt and what basically resulted in them being freed from Pharaoh to be able to leave out of Egypt. Because remember the whole story of the Exodus. Moses and Aaron start off going to Pharaoh saying, let my people go. You know, our God has sent us to you. He wants you to let our people go. Let us go 3 days journey into the wilderness. We want to sacrifice and have, you know, a feast to our God. Well, Pharaoh digs his heels in and says, no, you know, and then a battle ensues. And, you know, basically God starts bringing plagues upon them. And he keeps coming back saying, God wants you to let our people go. And Pharaoh digs his heels in and says, no, I won't do it. You know, and finally, they go through a series of 10 plagues, and it's finally when the death of the firstborn happens, the night that they ate the Passover sacrifice, you know, when the firstborn are killed, that's when Pharaoh gives in and says, I've had enough, get out. You know, and that enables them to leave. Now, let's notice several verses that are going to tell us that's what he meant by he brought them out by night, by the miracles that happened that night. And to see this, turn over to Exodus chapter 13. It's Exodus 13 here. And we'll start reading in verse 13. But every firstling of the donkey you shall redeem with a lamb, and you shall not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. And all the firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. So it shall be when your sons ask you in time to come, saying, why is this? Then you shall say to them, by strength of hand, Jehovah brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And notice how he brought them out. It's not referring to just physically walking out. You know, let's notice how he brought them out. In verse 15, and it came to pass when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that Jehovah killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animal. Therefore I sacrifice to Jehovah all males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. Now notice here, he brought them out by killing the firstborn, basically the plague that was the last straw for Pharaoh. You know, because, you know, again, there's a series of plagues, and Pharaoh keeps saying no, and that's finally when Pharaoh's like, okay, just get out. I can't take any more. Now, let's notice this a couple more times. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 7, because that's when he refers to brought them out. He's not saying that's when they physically walked out at night. This is how he brought them out. This is Deuteronomy 7 and verse 16. And you shall destroy all the peoples whom Jehovah your God delivers over to you. Your eye shall not have, and it shall have no pity on them, nor shall you serve their gods, for that will be a snare to you. And if you should say to your heart, these nations are greater than I, how can I dispossess them? You shall not be afraid of them, but you shall remember well what Jehovah your God did to Pharaoh and to all Egypt, and the great trials which your eyes saw, and the signs and wonders, and the mighty hand, and the outstretched arms, by which Jehovah your God brought you out. So shall Jehovah your God do to all the peoples of whom you are afraid. Notice he brought them out through the plagues that he brought upon the Egyptians, and the final one being the death of the firstborn. That's what brought about their release. That's how he brought them out. Now, notice this again in Deuteronomy 26. It's Deuteronomy 26 and verse 6. But the Egyptians mistreated us, afflicted us, and laid hard bondage on us. Then we cried out to Jehovah, God of our fathers, and Jehovah heard our voice and looked on our affliction and our labor and our oppression. So Jehovah brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm, with great terror and with signs and wonders. In other words, he brought them out through all the plagues that he brought upon the Egyptians that caused Pharaoh to give in and to tell them they could leave and literally thrust them out and tell them, get out and get out now. You know, because again, the previous nine plagues, you know, Pharaoh didn't like it, but he just kept digging in his heels and wouldn't let them go. So see, when it says he brought them out by night, that night is when that final plague took place. It doesn't say they marched out that night. It says they were brought out by night. Because remember, we won't go into the verses addressing this. And again, this is in the study paper that I mentioned. It mentions when they were leaving, they were watching the Egyptians bury their dead. Obviously, there was daylight for them to be able to see that. And see, let's also notice another detail here. Because as I mentioned before, we kind of made up an appointed time that all of my life was oftentimes been referred to as the night to be much observed. And we treated that as if it was a commanded assembly, you know, a specific appointed time. But what was always puzzling is if you read through Leviticus 23, you know, is if you read from verse 1 starting off, it says, you know, these are the appointed times, and it's a chapter listing them all, and look for one that's called the night to be much observed. You're not going to find it because it's not there. because we unfortunately misinterpreted another verse, and again, we combined it with our misinterpretation of Deuteronomy 16, verse 1, again, to come up with this idea that that was a night memorializing the Israelites physically walking out that night, and they didn't physically walk out that night. They walked out the next morning. I mean, yes, they left on the 15th, on the first day of unleavened bread, but during the daylight hours. But let's notice here in Exodus 12, in verse 40, because we'll see here the verse that was oftentimes misinterpreted here, again, to come up with this concept that what we call the night to be much observed was somehow a uniquely appointed time, you know, called out from everything else. Let's pick up in verse 40. Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of 430 years, on that very same day it came to pass that all the armies of Jehovah went out from the land of Egypt. It is a night of solemn observance to Jehovah for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night, Jehovah, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. Now, so we pulled verse 42 out and kind of made up an appointed time because, you know, there was a brief reference to marching out of Israel prior to that. And we kind of missed the fact that the verses that follow it are all defining the rules for who could participate in the Passover meal, which was the night of solemn observance. But just keep reading. Verse 43. And Jehovah said to Moses and Aaron, "This is the ordinance of the Passover. No outsider shall eat it." See, this is the night of solemn observance that it's going on to further explain. "But every man's servant who is bought for money, when you have circumcised him, then he may eat of it. A sojourner and a hired servant shall not eat it. In the house it shall be eaten, and you shall not carry any of the flesh outside of the house, nor shall you break one of its bones. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And when a stranger or sojourns with you and wants to keep the Passover to Jehovah, let all his males be circumcised and let him come near and keep it, and he shall be a native of the land. No uncircumcised person shall eat of it." Notice these are the rules surrounding, you know, the Passover meal and who's allowed to participate. That's the night of solemn observance that it's referring to here. Because you also need to consider one other detail. Because as I mentioned, you know, those that argue that, you know, the killing of the lamb is between sunset and dark, you know, at the beginning of you know, the 14th, place the meal, you know, that night at the beginning of the 14th as well. But they place the actual walking out of Egypt beginning the 15th. And in other words, basically it's 24 hours later, you know, from the time that they're, you know, actually doing the Passover sacrifice. Now, if you think that through, you know, what you've got is not only a contradiction, you've got Christ, our Passover sacrifice, dying at the wrong time, because we know he died on the afternoon of the 14th. Well, if the appointed time for the Passover sacrifice is the evening prior, we got a problem because Christ doesn't fulfill the appointed time of Passover, and he's our Passover. That's a monumental problem. You know, but the other problem that we have is, notice that they had to eat the meal in haste, dressed and ready to leave. Now think about that in terms of the scenario that they don't actually leave until the following evening. In other words, they got lots of time to prepare for when they're actually going to leave. So just notice here in Exodus 12 in verse 11. "And thus you shall eat it with a belt on your waist and with sandals on your feet and a staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It is Jehovah's Passover." In other words, they're eating it with a sense of urgency, dressed and ready to go. Okay. If you're doing that, but you don't leave till tomorrow night, is it really important that you be dressed and ready to go? Because, see, we know they had to stay in that whole night, and they can't get out till sunrise. Because we can see that if you skip down to verse 21. Then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, pick out and take lambs for yourselves according to your families and kill the Passover. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood. It is in the basin, and strike the lintel on the doorpost and the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning. So we know they can't leave until that morning. But if they're going to wait around and they got another 12 hours, you know, to get themselves ready to leave, and they're not going to leave until after sunset the following evening, why is there a need to already be dressed and your sandals on and you're dressed and your staff's in your hand and you're doing it in haste? You have a sense of urgency. It's like you're a runner on a track meet and, you know, you're already down in the starter blocks and you're hunched and you're just waiting for the starter pistol to go off. Why is this sense of urgency if you've got an extra 12 hours after you're allowed to go out to get yourself together before you leave? Now, see, if you're going to leave at sunrise, as soon as God says, you know, the starter pistol goes off and now you can go outside and you're going to leave immediately, well, now it makes sense to do it all in haste. See, if we put all this together, it's clear what the timing of the Old Covenant Passover is. You know, as we saw clearly, you know, Ben Harbahim, between the two evenings, is an afternoon time frame. It has to be for the morning sacrifice to come before the evening sacrifice on the same calendar day. And most importantly, Christ is our Passover sacrifice. He has to fulfill the requirements, the appointed time, which the Bible makes a very big deal of, for Passover. He has to be offered at the appropriate time. If the appropriate time is between sunset and dark, the evening before, and Christ is not killed until the following afternoon, he doesn't fulfill that, and we have a monumental problem. You know, so you can see, obviously, you know, where this is in terms of timing. Now, as I mentioned, there's a lot of other issues associated with the Passover, the Old Covenant and the New Covenant Passover, that we won't get into in this particular series. You know, as I mentioned, if you want to study that in more detail, the study papers on my website will go into both Passovers and a lot of arguments that we're not going to even touch in this series and discuss them in much more detail. But as I mentioned in the beginning of the sermon, oftentimes when people correctly understand here what the Bible says about the Passover, about the timing of the Old Covenant Passover, this leads to debates regarding the New Covenant Passover, you know, in spite of the fact that the New Covenant Passover tells us it's the night of which Christ was betrayed. And then they struggle to understand, okay, why is that timing different? Okay, well, we're going to cover that next time and address again the timing issues and explain why those issues are different and why that timing doesn't exactly match in terms of when the meals are. So at this point, we'll conclude, and I'll just say, tune in next time for the Passover controversy, part 2.